This is LifeMint.com and you're listening to the Mint Editors Podcast with me, Nandita Mathur, and Mint's editor, R. Sukumar. Yesterday was 2 years of the Modi government, and Mint has a special package of stories by our staffers, expert columns, and even an opinion poll. And it was a pretty holistic coverage because it ranged from politics to economics, finance, agrarian crisis, and so on. So first we will discuss this package.
I think it's been an eventful 2 years. It's interesting because there have been a lot of changes that have been made, even on the policy front. And I'd like to go back to the economic survey that comes before the budget. Mm-hmm. And this is the 2015 one, which was produced, where for the first time we got a hint that this government's approach would really be in terms of incremental reform, as opposed to what analysts and everyone likes to call big bang reform. Mm-hmm. For one, I think the term big bang reform is a sort of a misnomer, because many of the big things, easy things have all been done. It's all the fairly difficult things that you have to do. So let me list the difficult things. The first one is really agricultural reform. And there, I think government will have to balance several factors. One is the fact that a lot of people in India are dependent on agriculture. Two is the fact that a lot of subsidies are going towards agriculture. Three is market reform in agriculture, right? To make fields more productive, to make sure the market for agriculture is very efficient and that producers get a fair price. And as a logical consequence, also development of food processing and food retail, right? And then you have labor reform, which is the second big thing. And the third big thing would really be land reform. Now, these are big things and hugely politically sensitive. And if you look at agricultural reform, I think this budget, the government has done a little bit towards it, and I'm hoping that it does more. Land and labor are tricky subjects. We all know where the government stands on it. But these are also issues that are either state subjects or concurrent subjects, which means both the center and the state can rule. Right. So I think this government is doing the sensible thing, especially given what it calls an emphasis of competitive and cooperative federalism, to let the states take the lead on this. There are several states that are run by BJP governments. Rajasthan has taken the lead in both labor and land reform, in even to the extent of allowing titling, right, which is a revolutionary thing, and we've written about this in the past. So I think all in all, it's not a bad report card in terms of what they've done. There are, of course, just as you have positives, you also have negatives. But one big positive is the fact that you don't have big corruption scandals. Sure, there have been things in Rajasthan, in Madhya Pradesh, which all seem to suggest that the BJP is not as corruption-free as they would like us to believe. But definitely, there is not the kind of wholesale, decentralized, anarchic corruption that we saw toward in the second term of the United Progressive Alliance. But on the other side, you also have the fact that in terms of education, in terms of culture, in terms of human resources, the fact that the BJP seems quite happy to let its ideological parent, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, take the lead in those matters and sort of dictate the agenda is disturbing, right? Because I think a lot of people, and to some extent I also believe this, see the Modi model as very similar to the Lee Kuan Yew model in Singapore. Except that I have a problem, and this is the big difference. I think Lee Kuan Yew was a man who believed tremendously in progressiveness, in modernism and in science, in modernity and in science. And if you look at the modernization that Singapore underwent, in many ways, became a liberal society in several aspects, other than information and freedom of expression and all, but let's keep that aside. And I think we should never discount the value of that emphasis on progressiveness and modernization.
I mean, the Modi government has also often been accused of being pro-poor and, you know, anti-business.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is, there were some people who believed before this government came to power that it would be a far right of center government in terms of its economic policy, which means free marketers to the exclusion of all else. Now, you know, and I know you can't do that in India. Not because it's bad politics. Of course, it's bad politics. It's also not fair.
Right.
India has a lot of poor people. You can't just wash your hands of them. Any government of the day has to take them along. I think inclusion is a big thing. You can't leave them behind. You have to ensure that redistribution of wealth happens. While we are a free market newspaper, we believe in profit. We don't believe in profiteering, right? And I think it's very important to make that distinction, one, and two, to also ensure that the fruits of growth are sort of shared among a lot of people. And I think that's what you see. So it's not a far right of center government when it comes to economic policies. It's a centrist government with a rightist leaning.
Mm-hmm. Any particular pieces that you enjoyed?
I liked quite a few pieces. I liked Anil's criticism, I won't call it criticism. I would call it a critic, because it listed all the good things as well as the bad things. And he believes that it's a glass half full. I'd personally like to think that it's a little more than half full, but I thought that was a very objective assessment. Niranjan had written a piece on what the economic blueprint needs to look like, right, and what we could do, mm-hmm, which again put forth some very interesting ideas. And again, it was a very fair assessment of what's been happening in this country. I think if you look at the last 2 years, this government has done a lot of things right. And you can't just wish away those things. You can list specific things that specific ministries have done. The power ministry, the roads ministry, the rail ministry, the petroleum ministry. All of these have done several things that should have been done quite some time back. So you are seeing some change happening in those areas.
So year three, people say, maybe the most critical now that the 2 years have gone past.
It always is, right? I mean, year one and two, you sort of get your bearings, you test the waters, you see what needs to be done. Also, let's not forget the fact that this is a government that has previously, NDA, National Democratic Alliance, has previously been in power only for 6 years in India's long democratic history since 1947. How do you get governance experience? By being in power. So, in political terms, fairly young and fairly new people in the job. Many of them have learned. Their ideas hopefully have been refined and improved, and they've learned new things. And I hope for everyone's sake that they're listeners, right? I mean, it's very important when you're a politician or a minister to be a listener and not just believe that you know best. So that's happened over the first 2 years. Year three is when you can do a lot of these plans. Year four and five will probably be years when you prepare for the next election, right? That's always the way in India. Although at this point in time, and we've said this in our analysis, at this point in time, when you look at the opposition and you look at leadership, the cupboard is bare. I mean, there is really no alternative.
What would be the top couple of issues, top of the mind for them to tackle in year three?
I think administrative reforms would be one, because that is the key to doing business, right? The second one, really, to kickstart investment, apart from everything you're doing in terms of making it easier to do business, I think it's also very important to understand that this problem of bad loans and stressed assets is not going away in a hurry. And I think we are giving it a lot of importance now, and I think that needs to continue over the next year. And you need to make sure that there is no repeat. Because if the Reserve Bank had not insisted that banks clean up their books, I don't think anyone would have realized the extent of the problem.
Great. So since we're on the issue of banks and payments, so the next story is on the payments bank model and how companies have actually dropped plans for payments bank.
10 companies and one individual received permission to start payments banks, which can offer a host of services. Can't really lend money, which is how you earn, but you can earn through transactions, you can earn through various other means. And in some ways, this was part of the Reserve Bank's effort to diversify the banking system in India, to create not just more banks, but to create multiple banks, and hopefully now to create large banks, right? Everyone thought it was a great thing. It is, because I think payments bank play a very critical role in the progress to a cashless economy. Extremely good from the perspective of efficiency of transactions. Will weed out corruption to some extent. Will weed out black money to some extent. Will make transactions faster and more efficient. But the thing is, who gets to be a payments bank? And I think perhaps driven by the fact that there was a deadline and they had to get their applications in, some of the applicants may not have done their homework. I personally think that a lot of companies which currently have what is called a cash box. Airtel, in many ways, keeps a cash box for us, right? It's our telco, right? The wallets that have come up, the wallet companies, electronic wallet companies, they also keep a cash box for us in some ways. These are companies which are naturally suited to becoming a payments bank in terms of reach, in terms of the services they currently provide. There are some other companies which probably are not. And it is always going to be a very high volume, low margin kind of business. Suits certain guys, doesn't suit certain others, which is what you're seeing now. I wish we'd had a situation, especially because the process was so competitive and RBI did a lot of work, and they are a little peeved with this, that companies had taken a little more care about their applications, but they didn't. Right. So be it. But I think there is definitely room for payments banks. It'll be very interesting to see how the Indian Postal Department, for instance, approaches this, because they have a license. Yeah. It'll be very interesting to see how Paytm does it, because to my mind, Paytm is among the more revolutionary companies we have in the digital space in India, and they are doing a lot of things right. To my mind, it'll be interesting to see how the telcos like Bharti approach this, because again, they have intrinsic strengths in this, and how they do it will again be interesting.
Right, so we'll have to see how this initiative takes shape. Next, we have the story of IITs and the startup hiring, which all got triggered because of the Flipkart.
That's right, yeah.
Deferring of the joining date.
To 17 IMA people to whom it had made offers, graduates to whom it had made offers. It's interesting because in some ways it fits the narrative that is emerging of startups, especially the bigger startups, what you call unicorns, beginning to focus on profitability, beginning to focus on the kind of performance metrics that everyone else should look at. And they should have done this quite some time back. And clearly, the Indian Institute of Management, Ahmedabad, is a little upset, because I think that was the first school where Flipkart made the offers and then sent letters saying we want to defer the joining date.
Right.
I'm told they wanted to do it with other hires they made from colleges, but after the bad press, I'm told that they're having a rethink about it. It's happened before in the IT sector with the large IT companies, the Wipros, the HCLs, where you hire thousands of people or maybe even hundreds. I think it's closer to thousands some years. And then you tell them, don't join in June, join in December. In some cases, the joining date was deferred by a year.
Mm-hmm.
In many of these cases, the people don't get paid in that period. So you're left hanging.
Right.
It's one of the, you'll have to be pragmatic about this, right? Companies do badly. And when companies do badly, they can no longer pay people and they will let them go. But the thing to do is to see whether they are growing very rashly and growing very irrationally and hiring irrationally. And there I would also think there's a little bit of hubris involved, right? I mean, if I'm going to be hiring, I would go to an IIM or an IIT only if I really need those people, because these are really good students who've been through a rigorous program and a rigorous selection process. I wouldn't go to hire them just to let the world know what kind of company I run because I'm hiring from IIMA and I'm a day one company. You know, so there's a little bit of ego and hubris that is involved there. Maybe you can't entirely discount that, especially in the case of startups. And that's clearly evident in some of the other guys who are now saying, don't worry, we'll hire you 17 people who haven't, Flipkart says it wants only in December now. Now that is complete hubris. You know, there's not even any chance of it being anything else. It's a chance to score some points over Flipkart, which these other companies are jumping at, which again, I think is fairly juvenile.
But is it like kind of not thinking through it properly?
Yeah,
yes,
sure, it is. But let's face the facts. It's quite possible that another startup or another large company, maybe even a bank or maybe even an investment bank or a consulting company, hires a lot of people from IIMs. It's been hired, and let's say this company has been hiring from the IIMs for like 15, 20 years, and then faces a hugely adverse situation. Let's assume it's a multinational, situation is in Europe or the US, has to lay off a few thousand people, a few hundred of them are in India, many of these new hires may lose jobs. It's a fact of life, right? That's what happens in business. I mean, the cycles have become sharper. But in the case of startups, the question, like I said a little while before, is do you really need these people? at a time when you are trying to become more rational about everything else, mm-hmm. including your profitability, your spending, your sales, your marketing, should you not have looked at this a little bit more closely? Because the offers were made only in February. And okay. this trend of companies, the startups, the unicorns, restructuring with an eye on other key important financial metrics is a little older than that. So maybe they could have avoided this.
But it's probably time that IITs also, you know, sort of make their interviewing process, and, you know, now they want to disclose, startups to disclose their balance sheets and funding. Maybe they should have thought about it a bit earlier as well.
I'm not sure that that's such a good move. I think you should let the students take a call on this themselves. Mm-hmm. By the time you graduate from engineering school, you're 21 years old, right? I mean, you're not a kid. And it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, maybe they're falling for the fat.
I mean, you're not a child at 21. So, right. so if a startup comes, and let's face it, there could be a startup which has got some funding, not much, but which is working on the most innovative and brilliant software product that's around.
Correct.
Why would you deprive that startup from the prospect of from hiring people? And why would you deprive your students from the opportunity to go and work in that company?
It's a risk.
No, let's also not forget that Palantir. So, you know, and this was true a few years back. I'm not sure, especially given what's happened to Peter Thiel, whether it's still talked of in the same league, because he's one of the guys who started that company. A few years ago, it was the most desirable software company. It's a very secretive software company, but the most desirable software company to work for in the world. Let's not forget the fact that at one point in time, Palantir was a startup too, with not too much money.
Correct.
So that, I think, is just a knee-jerk reaction of the kind that is very common in India. So IIT professors getting together and saying, how dare you do this, and, you know, all of that.
So those were Sukumar's top stories for this week. Do let us know what you think. You can email us at feedback@livemint.com or follow us at LiveMint on Twitter and Mint on Facebook. Thank you for listening, and see you next Friday.